Reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature from the Sports Illustrated website. Headline reads, Rory McIlroy says that he is unhappy with the media and his play. The Masters champion spoke Saturday at Oakmont, his first post-round interview after a major round since Augusta, and expressed frustration with reporters. This feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Bob Herrig. Rory McIlroy spoke to the media after his third round at the U.S. Open, his first post-round major media session since winning the Masters. Dateline, Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Something is amiss with Rory McIlroy, and yet it is difficult to decipher what exactly it is. Sure, he's dealing with the Masters hangover. He's not thrilled with his game at the moment and is frustrated by an exacting Oakmont Country Club course. And he is clearly miffed with the media, although aside from the driver issue at the PGA Championship, even that is somewhat mysterious. For the first time following a round at the last two major championships, McIlroy spoke to reporters after shooting a 74 to complete 54 holes at the U.S. Open at 10 over par and well out of contention. Asked specifically about his frustrations, McIlroy gave a mixed answer. Quote, "It's more frustration with you guys," he said to a group of reporters. When asked in what way, he said, "I don't know. I've been totally available for the last few years, and I'm not saying maybe not you guys, but maybe more than just the whole thing," unquote. McIlroy then was asked about the driver issue at the PGA Championship. He clearly was then and remains now annoyed with the fact that confidential information about driver testing was leaked and ultimately reported. While driver testing is routine and players have to replace their clubs if they don't conform, McIlroy seems to not only have a problem with the fact that the information got out, but also that it was reported. Quote, "Yeah, part of it. I mean, that was part of it. Yeah, that was part of it," McIlroy said. "But it's not as if, like at Augusta, I skipped you guys on Thursday following the first round. So again, it's not as if it's out of the ordinary. I've done it before. I'm just doing it a little more often," unquote. McIlroy has said previously that talking to the media is not required, and how, if that is the case, you have to expect that players will sometimes decline. He's also been a frequent interview subject due to his stature in the game, his level of success, and his dealings in PGA Tour governance issues. McIlroy has often been a go-to source for information or opinion on the ongoing negotiations that the PGA Tour is having with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. McIlroy was available pre-tournament last week at the Canadian Open and after each of the tournament rounds when he missed the cut. He did a pre-tournament interview session last Tuesday at Oakmont. It hasn't helped that McIlroy is not playing well. He tied for 47th at the PGA Championship, missed the cut by 12 shots at the Canadian Open, and needed to hold on Friday to make the cut here, finishing at 146, 6 over par to make the cut by 1. Even that didn't seem to make his mood much better. Quote, "It's funny, like it's much easier being on the cut line when you really don't care if you're here for the weekend or not," McIlroy said, chuckling. "I was sort of thinking, do I really want 2 more days here or not? So it makes it easier to play better when you're in that mindset. I've certainly experienced times where I haven't played the way that I've wanted to. So yeah, like it's not, I actually feel like I've played okay this week. It's sort of the golf course where the tiniest mistakes get penalized a lot, and that's sort of how it's felt this week," unquote. McIlroy acknowledged again that the aftermath of winning the Masters and completing the career Grand Slam has created a new dynamic for him that is going to require an adjustment. Quote, "I alluded to it in my pre-tournament press conference. You don't really know how it's going to affect you," he said. "You don't know how you're going to react to such a, well, I wouldn't say a life-altering occasion, but at least something that I've dreamt about for a long time. Yeah, I alluded to the fact that I've felt a little flat on the golf course afterwards," unquote. After the U.S. Open, he will have a few weeks off before resuming play at the Scottish Open, followed by the British Open. Asked about his hopes on Sunday at the U.S. Open, McIlroy said, quote, "Hopefully a round in under 4.5 hours and get out of here," unquote. And again, that feature is entitled, "Rory McIlroy Says That He's Unhappy with the Media and His Play," written by Sports Illustrated writer Bob Herrig. And from golf news, let's turn now to some hockey news. The next headline reads, "Brad Marchand makes history with 2 goals in the Panthers' win." This feature, written by Greg Wyszynski of Sports Illustrated, Dateline, Edmonton, Alberta. Brad Marchand didn't just lead the Florida Panthers to within 1 win of lifting the Stanley Cup with his Game 5 heroics Saturday night. He made NHL playoff history. Marchand became the first player to score at least 5 goals in 2 separate Stanley Cup final series with 2 different teams. He scored 5 goals in 7 games for the Boston Bruins in their 2011 Stanley Cup championship win over the Vancouver Canucks. His 2 vital goals in the Panthers' 5-2 win in Game 5 against the Edmonton Oilers gave him 6 goals in 5 games in this Stanley Cup final. What would 2011 Brad Marchand think of 2025 Brad Marchand doing this at the age of 37 years old? Quote, "Man, that guy's good looking. That would probably be it," he said after the game, drawing laughter. "Sometimes you get bounces, sometimes you don't. But definitely grateful to have another opportunity to be in the finals and to be part of a really good team," unquote. Marchand now has 10 goals and 10 assists in 22 playoff games for the Panthers. He made even more history in the Panthers' Game 5 win. He's just the second player in NHL history to have five or more goals in multiple Stanley Cup finals, with Hall of Famer Mario Lemieux the last one to accomplish the feat. Florida goalie Sergei Bobrovsky said, quote, "He's amazing. He's been a leader for us. He's been scoring big goals for us. And tonight, he made a hell of an effort by himself," unquote. Marchand opened the scoring at 9:12 of the first period with a great individual effort, corralling a loose puck, shielding it from Edmonton defenseman Matthias Ekholm, and fired it past Calvin Picard, who got to start over Stuart Skinner in Game 5. Sam Bennett scored his 15th goal of the playoffs late in the first period to make it 2-0, which remained the margin until Marchand struck again in the third period on an even more impressive individual effort. Line mate Etu Lostenorin poked the puck ahead to Marchand, who deked defenseman Jake Walman to the ice with a move to the net before tucking the puck through Picard's hole for the 3-0 lead. Bennett was left astonished by the second Marchand goal. Quote, "I mean, they're both unbelievable, but that second one, I don't know how he did that," Bennett said. "We're going to have to watch that clip a couple times and ask him to teach me something," unquote. Florida coach Paul Maurice said that he knew Marchand was skilled before the Panthers acquired him from the Bruins at the NHL trade deadline in March, as the winger is 20 points away from 1,000 points in his 16-year NHL career. But until he got on the ice with him, Maurice didn't realize how great Marchand was with the small area things that he does, like on his 2 goals in Game 5. Quote, "What he can do under duress in a small area is world class. He's as good as I've seen," Maurice said. The Panthers are now 1 victory away from back-to-back Stanley Cup championships, bouncing back from a Game 4 overtime loss on home ice that evened the series at 2 games apiece. Again, it's Marchand who has led the way whenever the Panthers stumble. The veteran winger has points in every game after a Florida loss, with 7 goals and 4 assists in those games. He also has 2 game-winning overtime goals after losses, including in Game 2 of this series. "I've said it a ton of times, we're just enjoying the moment," Marchand said. "It's a special time, special memories we're going to have forever. Not really nervous, just excited," unquote. The Panthers continued to be one of the most successful road teams in NHL playoff history, with a dominant, suffocating effort against the Oilers. Florida built a 3-0 lead with a relentless forecheck, great penalty killing on 3 Edmonton power plays, and a strong 19-save effort from Bodovsky. The Oilers, with a chance to take control of the series on home ice, were held scoreless for the first 47 minutes of the game. Having previously blown multi-goal leads in the series, the Panthers remained poised as the Oilers twice cut their deficit to 2 goals on scores by Connor McDavid and Corey Perry. But Sam Reinhart and Lostarinen each scored to give Florida a 3-goal advantage, the latter on an empty netter for the final tally. The Panthers are 10 wins, 3 losses on the road, tying the single playoff year record held by 6 other teams, 5 of whom won the Stanley Cup. To break the record, the Panthers would have to return to Edmonton for a Game 7. They would rather not have the chance. Quote, the more times you're in situations like this, the more comfortable you're going to be. We've been staying in the moment very well all postseason, said Reinhart. Florida has a chance to close out the Oilers for the Stanley Cup on Tuesday night at home, but that has not been a guarantee for the Panthers. They failed to eliminate the Toronto Maple Leafs in Game 6 of their second-round series, needing a seventh game to beat the Leafs. They also lost a closeout game against the Carolina Hurricanes in the Eastern Conference Finals, not to mention the three elimination game losses that they suffered against the Oilers in last season's Stanley Cup Final before winning in Game 7. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins said that the Oilers are ready to rally again. Quote, we're never going to quit on each other, he said. We're going into Florida with a job to do, and we'll do everything that we can to do it, unquote. Bennett said that the Panthers have grown since nearly squandering the championship a year ago. Quote, it's extremely tough. It's a moment you think about your whole life, and it's in the back of your head. I think we can learn from that experience from last year, he said. I think we're already looking ahead before we were ready to put into work to get the job done. We know what we have to do now, unquote. And again, that feature is entitled Brad Marchand Makes History with Two Goals in the Panthers' Win, written by Greg Wyshynski of ESPN. And from hockey news, let's turn now to some baseball news. The next feature has a headline that reads, Major League Baseball's trendsetters are going retro with their rotation. The Tampa Bay Rays have established a reputation for being on the cutting edge of baseball strategy, but they are suddenly looking to the past when it comes to pitching. And this feature is written by Nick Selby of Sports Illustrated. Last Wednesday, Boston Red Sox outfielder Roman Anthony, the game's consensus number one prospect, lined a double down the left field line for his first big league hit. It gave Boston a 2-0 lead in the first inning and created an inauspicious start for Tampa Bay Rays starter Ryan Pepiot. Pepiot settled in from there, allowing just one more run the rest of the way over 5 2/3 innings. But Anthony's base hit proved to be the difference in a 3-1 defeat. On a micro level, the day was a disappointing one, but from a zoomed-out perspective, it was yet another positive step for a Tampa Bay Rays pitching staff that has gained steam by bucking the franchise's typical new-age roster management tendencies. If they weren't the inventors of it, the Rays can certainly be credited with popularizing the use of openers. For years, Tampa Bay has sought advantages by churning pitchers in and out of the bullpen and de-emphasizing the traditional five-man starting rotation after utilizing bullpen games to cover huge swaths of innings. From the years 2018 to 2024, Rays starting pitchers ranked no higher than 19th in innings pitched, twice ranking dead last in 2018 and 2022. Last season, Rays starters ranked 23rd in innings and 26th in quality starts. Through the first 2+ months of the 2025 season, though, the script has completely flipped. The Rays, somewhat astonishingly, lead the majors in starting pitcher innings so far. Five pitchers, Pepio, Drew Rasmussen, Zach Littell, Taj Bradley, and Shane Baz, have combined to start 67 of Tampa Bay's 68 games this season. Only the Los Angeles Angels have used fewer starting pitchers, and only the Philadelphia Phillies have thrown more quality starts. That level of consistency doesn't just set Tampa Bay apart from the rest of the league this year. It completely upends the way that the organization has approached pitching for the better part of a decade. From 2018 to 2024, the Rays logged the fifth most wins in the league and made the postseason six times. During that span, only five out of the team's 107 starting pitchers, Zach Eflin, Shane McClanahan, Corey Kluber, Charlie Morton, and Blake Snell, logged enough innings to qualify for the ERA title. To date, all five of the Rays' current starters meet that threshold. The extreme shift in pitching usage comes as a result of a few different factors. Understanding how we got here becomes clearer after taking a look at how each of the Tampa Bay Five arrived at this point in their respective careers. Let's start with Rasmussen, who underwent two Tommy John surgeries before the Milwaukee Brewers drafted him in the sixth round in 2018. He debuted for Milwaukee in 2020 and pitched almost exclusively in relief before being traded to the Rays in the Willie Adams deal. Tampa Bay made him a starter, and the right-hander thrived in his new role, posting a 2.84 ERA over 146 innings in 2022. A strained forearm cost him most of the 2023 and 2024 seasons, though he's made his way back to full strength this year and picked up right where he left off, putting up a 2.29 ERA in 13 starts. He has pitched into the fifth inning each time out and made it through six frames in four of his last five games, allowing just two runs during that stretch. For Rasmussen to evolve into an every-fifth-day ace, it has been all about staying healthy and bulking up to the point where he can withstand logging this many innings. Pepio's situation is one of opportunity. The right-hander languished in the Los Angeles Dodgers minor league system for 4 years before finally cracking the big league roster in 2023. He never got a bigger role than as a swingman, though, and was traded to Tampa as part of the return for Tyler Glasnow. The Rays slotted him right into their rotation, and he immediately thrived, logging a 3.60 ERA over 130 innings last season. After an up-and-down start to 2025, he has a 2.49 ERA over his last seven starts, pitching into the sixth in all seven. Littell was in his sixth major league season when he landed with the Rays in May of 2023 as a waiver claim after the Red Sox designated him for assignment. At that point, he was your prototypical journeyman reliever. Tampa Bay was Littell's seventh different organization. All but four of his 147 career appearances prior to arriving in St. Petersburg came in relief. The Rays, though, saw something in Lentell that the others didn't. They tinkered with his pitch mix, adding a splitter and stretching him out into a starting pitcher by the end of the 2023 campaign. The experiment drastically changed his career. He made a team-high 29 starts last season, and last month threw the first complete game for the Rays in nearly 4 years. Yet another sign that times are changing in Tampa. In Bradley and Baz, the Rays have two young arms who were nurtured in their minor league system. Tampa Bay drafted Bradley in the fifth round in 2018 when he was just 17. By 2022, he made it to Triple A and made his big league debut the following season. Baz was similarly a prospect darling ever since the Pittsburgh Pirates selected him with the 12th pick in the 2017 draft and subsequently traded him to the Rays. Both were the franchise's representatives in the Futures game, and while each has had ups and downs in the big leagues, their potential has been on full display frequently enough that the organization has trusted them to take the ball on a regular cadence. Holistically, the group represents everything that the Rays do so well. They took another organization's afterthoughts and cast-offs, Rasmussen, Pepio, and Littell, and turned them into key contributors. They developed high upside arms in Bradley and Baz, building them up gradually to get them ready for bulk innings. Add it all up, and it's a formidable five-man rotation that has logged heavy innings to keep a dynamic bullpen fresh and up to a respectable 3.74 ERA, all while making less than $13 million combined in 2025. In some ways, a five-man rotation that never changes is as antiquated as sacrifice bunts and pitchers hitting for themselves. But the way that Tampa Bay assembled this group and is leaning on it as a strength is simply a continuation of what has made the Rays the model small-market franchise of the 21st century. And again, that feature is entitled Major League Baseball's Trendsetters Are Going Retro with Their Pitching Rotation, written by Nick Selby of Sports Illustrated. And from baseball news, let's turn now to some golf news. Headline reads, J.J. Spaun wins a wild U.S. Open with iconic 64-foot putt on his final hole. The 34-year-old won his maiden major title after a weather delay wreaked havoc on the field and the course. And this feature is written by Max Schreiber of Sports Illustrated. Usually, the British Open is the major championship in which the weather is the biggest factor, but this year's U.S. Open might be able to claim that title. It also possesses perhaps the greatest major clinching putt ever. At 4:01 p.m. in the final round, a downpour came over Oakmont Country Club, and play was suspended with 54-hole leader Sam Burns atop the leaderboard at 2 under par with 11 holes to play. Play resumed at 5:37 p.m. with wet conditions yielding one of the wildest finishes in championship history. And with a euphoric 64-foot birdie putt on the 72nd hole, J.J. Spaun hoisted the U.S. Open trophy under Pittsburgh's fading daylight. He finished at 1 under, the only player under par in the 156-player field, with a final round 72. Quote, "To finish it off like this is just a dream," Spawn said afterward. "You watch other people do it. You see the Tiger Woods chip shot at the 2005 Masters. You see Nick Taylor's 72-foot putt at the 2023 RBC Canadian Open. You see crazy moments. To have my own moment like that at this championship, I'll never forget this moment." Unquote. After the delay, the course was drenched, and those who thought that they were once out of the contention were suddenly back in the hunt. John Rahm, who finished early on Sunday, held the clubhouse lead at 4 over par, and there were murmurs that he might need to turn his flight around. Ultimately, Robert McIntyre became the clubhouse leader at 1 over par with a final round 68. The final group of Burns and Adam Scott had 3 holes to play. The penultimate pairing of Spawn and Victor Hovland was on number 17, and Tyrrell Hatton bogeyed his last 2 holes with a chance to emerge victorious. Burns's lead evaporated with a double bogey on number 11 and a bogey on number 12. Then his chances were mostly dashed on the par 4 15th. Burns asked for a rules official seeking relief with his ball landing in a soggy lie, but he was denied and made double bogey en route to a tie for 7th finish at 4 over par. Quote, "From that point, Burns's caddy, Travis Perkins, and I said, 'Look, let's focus on the shot and try to execute,'" Burns said of the ruling. "I did the best I could. I was 100% locked in on what I was trying to do. Ultimately, it felt like the water just kind of got in the way, and I went left. It is what it is." Unquote. Scott, seeking his 2nd career major, fell out of the mix with a final round 79, and Hovland finished in 3rd place at 2 over. Spawn and McIntyre were seemingly the last 2 players fazed the least by the delay. Spawn opened up with a bogey-free 66 and was 1 back of the lead entering on Sunday. Playing the front 9 at 5 over par in the final round after a series of bad breaks, Spawn plummeted down the leaderboard. But as others imploded after making the turn, 2 birdies on holes number 12 and 14 revived his chances at victory. Spawn took the lead by driving the par 4 17th en route to a birdie. Then, clinging to a 1-stroke lead, he was hoping to 2-putt from 64 feet for the title. Instead, he holed it, the longest putt by anyone this week. And pandemonium in Pittsburgh. In 235 PGA Tour starts, Spawn, who came into the week ranked number 25 in the world, had 1 win, the 2022 Valero Texas Open. In 8 career major starts, his best finish was a tie for 23rd at the 2022 Masters. A year ago, the 34-year-old Californian contemplated quitting the sport. Then he watched a movie called Wimbledon, which inspired him to keep going. Quote, "Last year in June, I was looking like I was going to lose my job," Spawn said. "And that was when I had that moment where, if this is how I go out, I might as well go down swinging," unquote. Using that mentality, he didn't miss a cut after the RBC Canadian Open and kept his card. Fast forward to this past March, he lost to Rory McIlroy in a 3-hole Monday playoff at the Players' Championship, splashing his tee shot on the famous par 3 17th. But he was so close. Now he's a U.S. Open champion and boasts an indelible putt that will be replayed forever. Quote, "It's definitely like a storybook, fairy tale ending," Spahn said. "Kind of underdog fighting back, not giving up, never quitting. With the rain and everything, and then the putt, I mean, you couldn't write a better story. I'm just so fortunate to be on the receiving end of that," unquote. And again, that feature is entitled J.J. Spahn Wins a Wild U.S. Open with Iconic 64-Foot Putt on His Final Hole, written by Sports Illustrated writer Max Schreiber. And from golf news, let's turn now to some women's basketball news. Next headline reads, Caitlin Clark stands alone in WNBA history after blistering hot five-game start. The Fever star has gotten her second year in the league off to a roaring start. And this feature written by Kristen Wong. The Indiana Fever sent an emphatic statement to the rest of the WNBA with their 102-88 victory against the New York Liberty over the weekend. But it was Fever star Caitlin Clark who arguably made the bigger statement in her thrilling first game back from a nagging quad strain. After missing roughly 2 weeks to recover from injury, Clark dropped a near triple-double and tied her career high in most three-pointers made in a game with 7 in Saturday's win. The second-year guard wasted no time getting on the stat sheet and making a unique bit of WNBA history as well. Following the Fever's win, Clark became the first WNBA player in history to tally more than 100 points, more than 30 assists, and more than 30 rebounds through her first 5 games of the season, according to a graphic from ESPN's First Take. She currently has racked up 108 points, 46 assists, and 32 rebounds over 5 games. Clark was already on a tear, beginning with the Fever's 2025 season opener, as she was the first in league history to start a season with back-to-back 20-plus point, 10-plus assist games. She was also the first ever to record multiple games with at least 25 points, 10 assists, 5 rebounds, and 5 made three-pointers. That's quite a lot of firsts for Clark, who looks even more dangerous in her second campaign in the WNBA. The 23-year-old phenom's playmaking, long-range shooting, and overall ability to wow fans night after night date back to her Iowa days, as well as her historic rookie campaign. And by the season's end, she will no doubt have notched many more accomplishments in her belt. The Fever are now 5 wins, 5 losses on the year, and will host the Connecticut Sun next on Tuesday night. And in another Caitlin Clark feature, this one's headlined, Fans Loved What Fever Coach Did After Caitlin Clark's Bad Turnover Versus Liberty. Clark tallied a team-high 7 turnovers during Saturday's win, and this feature also written by Kristen Wong of Sports Illustrated. Even as one of the marquee faces of the WNBA, Caitlin Clark is bound to have her bad moments on the court. Thankfully, she has an experienced head coach in Stephanie White by her side to show her support, but also tough love when she needs it most. Clark dominated in her first game back from injury during the Indiana Fever's 102-88 win over the New York Liberty on Saturday, coming close to a triple-double and tying her career high of most three-pointers in a game. The superstar guard looked very well rested following her hiatus, and while she seemed to make everything from long range, she didn't always make the best decisions. During one play early in the fourth quarter, the Fever held a single-digit lead over the defending champs and were trying to keep their momentum going. Clark, being the team's primary playmaker, dribbled the ball for a bit on the perimeter before trying to find teammate Lexi Hull on the right side, but her pass was easily intercepted by the Liberty's Sabrina Ionescu. Clark tracked all the way back in transition to commit a shooting foul on Brianna Stewart, sending Stewie to the line. Immediately afterward, White called Clark over to the sidelines and appeared to give her a stern talking to about her offensive turnover. In truth, it's really not a unique or out-of-the-ordinary moment for a WNBA head coach, but it's still nice to see White not letting Clark get away with any sloppy plays in her second year in the league. Despite the Fever's big win, Clark finished the game with a team-high 7 turnovers. White elaborated on that turnover in particular during the Fever's post-game press conference, noting that Clark probably should have made the easy pass to Damaris Dantas, who was wide open at the top of the key. Quote, "Being able to harness those moments when it's really rolling and being able to be patient in the moments where you're trying to get it rolling, I think it's a growth process," White said. The turnover where Clark missed Damaris Dantas right beside her and tried to throw it to somebody else in the corner, maybe I'll introduce her to DD in the locker room. But where again, then we have the conversation about not making the home run play, just making the easy one. And she managed the game impeccably from there on out, unquote. And trust that Clark will make sure that she picks the right pass next time around. And again, that feature, entitled "Fans Loved What Fever Coach Did After Caitlin Clark's Bad Turnover Versus Liberty," written by Kristen Wong of Sports Illustrated. And here's one more short Caitlin Clark feature. Headline reads, "Caitlin Clark floored by fans who took a 22-hour flight to watch her play." Five fans traveled all the way from Hong Kong to watch Clark play. She was honored. This feature written by Tim Capurso of Sports Illustrated. In her return to the court after a 5-game absence due to a left quad strain, Caitlin Clark didn't waste any time getting back into her groove as she poured in 32 points, drained 7 three-pointers, and flirted with a triple-double while helping the Indiana Fever hand the New York Liberty its first loss of the season on Saturday. Clark put on a show for the 17,274 fans in attendance at Gainbridge Fieldhouse, draining a trio of triples from way downtown in rapid succession during an impressive sequence at the end of the first quarter. Clark's performance was even more memorable for five fans in particular, for they had traveled nearly 8,000 miles and had taken a 22-hour flight from Hong Kong to Indiana to watch Clark play. When told of her rapidly growing fan base in Hong Kong and the dedicated fans who had made the long journey to see the Fever's 102-88 victory, Clark was floored. "No way," Clark exclaimed. "I wish I could have met them. If you know them, tell them thank you for coming. That's incredible." Yeah, maybe we'll head to Hong Kong after the season, Clark said when asked if she has any plans to visit the city. I certainly hope to go to Hong Kong one day. It's incredible to see the type of reach that can have and how much people love basketball all across the globe. So that's really cool. If you know them, tell them I say hello and thanks for coming as well, unquote. Clark's popularity has been a boon for the WNBA and women's basketball in general, and it truly knows no bounds or borders. The only logical next step is for Clark to somehow meet these dedicated fans. And again, that feature is entitled Caitlin Clark Floored by Fans Who Took 22-Hour Flight to Watch Her Play, written by Tim Capurso of Sports Illustrated. And from basketball news, let's turn now to some football news. Next headline reads, Steelers offensive coordinator makes offensive identity clear after adding Aaron Rodgers and DK Metcalf. Pittsburgh's offensive should look very different from 2024. And this feature written by Dan Lyons of Sports Illustrated. The 2025 Pittsburgh Steelers offense will look very different from the 2024 Steelers attack. After yet another season with an above-average record and wild-card round playoff loss, Mike Tomlin and the Pittsburgh front office look to transform the offense. For better or worse, mission accomplished. The team traded for Seattle Seahawks burner DK Metcalf in early March, adding a top-flight deep threat before trading fellow wide receiver George Pickens to the Dallas Cowboys weeks later. It let running back Najee Harris walk in free agency, with the veteran back signing with the Los Angeles Chargers, likely elevating Jaylen Warren into the true RB1 role, while rookie Caleb Johnson joins the team from Iowa. And, of course, after weeks of speculation, the team signed Aaron Rodgers at quarterback. After being one of the most run-heavy offenses in the NFL a year ago, offensive coordinator Arthur Smith indicated that he plans to have the new-look offense air it out much more this season. Quote, obviously, we didn't bring Aaron in here and sign DK for all that money to go run the wishbone, Smith said last week, according to the Post-Gazette. You try to play to the strengths of your team. Every year will be different. You evolve with who you have personnel-wise, and strategically there are things that you want to evolve to. A lot of times, that's how rosters are made, off-season acquisitions, free agency, the draft. I've had a lot of different quarterbacks with a lot of different skill sets. Your job as a coach is to play to the strengths of your players. You adapt to the personnel that you have, unquote. The personnel this year is much different from where the franchise began 2024. With the mobile Justin Fields under center to start the season, it made sense to feature a heavy run game. That evolved with Russell Wilson, less mobile than he was earlier in his career, taking over a few weeks into the season and ultimately stalling out after a promising start. Now the Steelers have one of the great deep ball throwers in NFL history in one of the NFL's fastest and most physical downfield threats on the outside. Whether it works is an open question, but it is clear that the Rodgers-led offense is going to be a much different animal than the Fields and Wilson-led offenses of 2024. And again, that feature is entitled Steelers offensive coordinator, makes offensive identity clear after adding Aaron Rodgers and DK Metcalf. Written by Dan Lyons of Sports Illustrated. And in other NFL quarterback news, the next one is headlined, Kirk Cousins' salary and no trade clause stand in the way of any trade. Interest in the Falcons' former starter was tepid. And this Sports Illustrated feature, written by Albert Breer. Is there any trade interest in Kirk Cousins right now? We've discussed this plenty, and we can discuss it again. The lack of a Kirk Cousins trade at this point in the offseason is due to the actions of all three parties needed to complete a deal: the Falcons, the quarterback-hungry suitors, and Cousins himself. First, as far as the Falcons, their culpability comes down to money. They went past the mid-March vesting date for a $10 million roster bonus for 2026 becoming fully guaranteed, ticking the number that they were responsible for from $90 million to $100 million. In doing so, they were implicitly saying that they'd rather have 2 years of Cousins, even if one of those years were with Cousins as a backup at $100 million than a single year at $90 million. And since they've been unwilling to take on enough of his money to facilitate a deal. Secondly, other teams involved, like Cleveland and Pittsburgh, who inquired, were not willing to take on the $27 million for this year in full, in addition to the $10 million for next year's 2026. Any discussion on the deal, at least as far as I've been able to ascertain, would have required the Falcons to essentially quote-unquote buy a draft pick by taking on a good chunk of Cousins' salary. Third, Kirk Cousins took the tact in March and April to see how the draft played out before waiving his no-trade clause to try to avoid a situation like the one he was in last year when the Falcons signed him and then took Michael Penix Jr. with the 8th pick. Did he overplay his hand? Somebody could argue yes, based on his current position. But again, action on Cousins was tepid enough to wonder if a deal could be done. Atlanta moves towards training camp with Penix entrenched as the starter and Cousins as the backup. And at least for now, it looks like it would make a material change to someone else's quarterback situation to provoke a trade. And of course, the blessing of Cousins, who might be hesitant to move his family after camp is underway. And one of our readers writes in with a question, do you have any concern of the Houston Texans' offensive line being a bunch of unknowns? Answer, of course I do. How could you not? They have one really good lineman, Titus Howard, who can play guard or tackle. Center is wide open. Left guard is too, with Howard likely lining up at right guard to start. Trent Brown, Cam Robinson, Blake Fisher, and rookie Ante Ursary are in the mix at tackle. Laken Tomlinson, Juice Scruggs, Jarrett Patterson, Jake Andrews, and Ed Ingram are battling inside. This is not exactly if you have two quarterbacks, you don't have one, but if you have 10 linemen, do you have five? The Texans are going to find out. And recently promoted line coach Cole Popovich shares Patriots roots with new coordinator Nick Gailey. The two were together for 5 years in New England, and there'll be pressure on them to get the position group right. If you look at the Texans roster, It may be the only big question mark going into training camp. But make no mistake, it is a significant question mark. Next NFL question, what is the likelihood that the Steelers re-sign Watt versus trade Watt? And if they sign him, how many millions? Answer, I have a hard time seeing how the Steelers do not find some common ground with T.J. Watt on a new contract that'll at least set him up to retire in Pittsburgh. He has $21 million left in the final year of the blockbuster deal he signed 4 years ago. That allows the team to fold a lower number into a contract with a well-deserved market correction. Watt is 30 years old, and he has had his injury problems. However, he played in all 17 games the past two seasons with 30.5 sacks. Bottom line, while Watt may not be the same guy in a year or two, it's hard to envision him falling off, given the kind of worker that he's always been. The investment is a safe one. I look at Watt's situation similar to Trey Hendrickson's in Cincinnati. I don't think he'll get a market-changing deal, but if Max Crosby and Danielle Hunter did extensions this offseason with new money APYs in the mid-30s, Watt would not be out of line asking for something in that range. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.